DBHDD is reminding Georgians to ask their doctor about alternatives to opioid pain medication. Alternatives such as over-the-counter medications and physical therapy can be used to manage pain. More information at opioidresponse.info.
Welcome to another edition of Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nyga, glad to have you with us on this Tuesday, April 13th. We're going to talk today about a subject that has been much in the news in Washington around the country, which is the filibuster, a tool used in the United States Senate that has gained a lot of attention because of the possibility that Republicans are able to use it right now to block some of what Joe Biden is hoping to accomplish as president. And we've got just a phenomenal panel to talk about this subject. So I want to start by giving you a personal story. I think that my first encounter with the filibuster was not in a government class or a civics class. I think the first time I learned about the filibuster was when I was probably 10 or 11 years old, sitting up late one night, watching the great Frank Capra picture, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Jimmy Smith playing Jefferson Smith, a young, naive senator, freshman elected by accident to come to Washington, is trying to protect land for a boys' camp that means so much to him. And he is thwarted time and again by powerful interests that want that land for development. So Jefferson Smith, Jimmy Stewart, decides to lead a filibuster to try to take the time needed to get out word to the people of his state why what he wants to do is so important. And in the climactic scene, Jimmy Stewart finally, after, 24, 25 hours without stopping, finally gives in. We'll listen to just a little of that right now.
You all think I'm licked. Well, I'm not licked. And I'm going to stay right here and fight for this lost cause. Even if this room gets filled with lies like these. And the tailors and all their armies come marching into this place. Somebody will listen to me.
And he collapses on the floor of the Senate. Well, the filibuster has been hasn't been used, I don't think, for such idealistic purposes over the years since then. And right now it is especially contentious. So we're going to talk about its history and about where we're headed with the filibuster today. It's Tuesday, which means I'm joined by my Tuesday partner from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, senior reporter Tamar Hallerman. Tamar, we should, of course, point out that you covered the United States Congress for a long time in Washington before moving to Atlanta, so you're well aware of the traditions and the rules of the U.S. Senate.
Absolutely. And I think the first time I became aware of the filibuster was also watching that very same movie. And when I first arrived on Capitol Hill in the early years of when Obama was president, seeing the way it was used in such a different way, it's so often now it is not that talking filibuster that became so famous. It's often a very quiet kind of behind the scenes thing, and you might not even realize it's happening sometimes. So I can't wait to dive in today.
I agree. I'm really thrilled that we're joined also for our conversation by former United States Senator Saxby Chambliss, who served two terms in the U.S. Senate after four terms in the U.S. House. Senator, thank you so much for being here. And a very quick note, because this hasn't been private, it's been covered by the media. You've now completely recovered from a very small stroke that you had, I think, last month. And we're so happy that you're back to full health and with us today. Thank you very much, Senator.
Well, thank you, Bill, and I appreciate your comment relative to my medical issues. And, boy, thanks for all the prayers and the thoughts of your listeners that I received. That, let me tell you, I am living proof that prayers work. So look back. We're back in the game and looking forward to getting a visit with you this morning.
You were in the U.S. Senate at an important moment when Harry Reid, through a procedural motion, was able to change one aspect, one rule in the Senate. We're going to talk about that as we move forward. But his change says something about the unintended consequences that can come out of tampering with traditions like the filibuster. We'll get to that a little later in the show. Oh, back with us again, professor of American history, chairman of the history department at Emory University, and the Jimmy Carter professor of history, Joe Crispino. Joe, how have you been?
Been good, Bill. Thanks so much. It's always a pleasure to be with you. You know, that clip you played of Jimmy Stewart, it just, I'm going to have to write a lecture about that. You know, I mean, it's fascinating. You know, that movie came out in 1939, same year as Gone with the Wind. And that line just that you played, you know, we talked about fight for this lost cause. It's interesting how those two films kind of can be paired together to think about a kind of the broad popular romance about the South that existed in the 1930s and 40s. And I think if you think about how the filibuster was used in that period to frustrate efforts to pass civil rights legislation, it's an interesting context in which to think about that film.
I do want to be careful before I introduce our final panelist to point out that Jefferson Smith, the Jimmy Stewart character, came from a Western state and was using Lost Cause in a very different context than it's used in Gone with the Wind. But it is an interesting thought, Joe. We are joined today for the first time by Stephen Dennis, a Washington correspondent for Bloomberg News, covers the U.S. Senate, covered Congress, the White House. You've been with Bloomberg, you said, Stephen, since about 2015, and before that with CQ, with Congressional Quarterly, Roll Call. You have a long history of covering Washington, yes?
Yeah, so about 15, 16 years now. And, you know, every year it seems to get a little bit more partisan and a little bit, you know, the two parties don't talk to each other all that much anymore. I mean, when I got there in 2005, there was still at least on a lot of big things, including the filibuster, some bipartisan groups that would get together, like the Gang of 14 that put off the nuclear option. You had folks like John McCain going over and talking to the Democrats and trying to prevent these big blow-ups. And, you know, so I've sort of seen it go from that, where Republicans almost went nuclear in 2005 and 2006, 2 years later when the Democrats did. And now, you know, you have sort of a new situation where most Senate Democrats right now, I think, would vote to get rid of the filibuster entirely.
Yeah, and we're gonna get into that. But I want to point out, Steve, that we have with us today a wonderful example of someone who tried to work across the aisle in Senator Chambliss as part of the Gang of Eight, among other things, Senator, working hard on trying to find a way to pass an actual immigration reform bill. So you're no stranger to working across the aisle during your two terms, Senator.
Yeah, and that's very honestly one of the great things about the filibuster, because it makes Republicans and Democrats sit down and negotiate. And what I found during my 20 years of public service, that when one side or the other is solely responsible for passing of whatever matter, the bill is not wood. It would have been better if there had been negotiations and bipartisan passage of a bill. And I know we're going to talk in the weeds relative to the filibuster, but that is still, particularly on the legislative calendar now, requires Republicans and Democrats to sit around and talk, just like Steve just referenced. And if it goes away, boy, it's going to be a sad day for the institution of the Senate.
So that is one very strong perspective on this. But Tamar, let's go back a step and talk first about exactly the whole idea of the filibuster. First of all, Tamar, I want to make something that I think people are not certain about. In some ways, this is going to be a primer for a little while, at least, on what the filibuster is and isn't. There are those who believe the filibuster was, in fact, a device of the Founding Fathers that they inserted into the U.S. Constitution out of a belief that you did need to have compromises, Saxby Chambliss just said. That is not, in fact, the case at all. The filibuster is the product of rules established by the U.S. Senate themselves, but it is certainly true to some extent, Tamar, that the filibuster was put in place for the reason Saxby talked about, Senator Chambliss, and that is to find a way for both parties to work together, compromise, sort out legislation in, you know, this notion of the cooling saucer of the Senate.
Yeah, exactly. We didn't really see it on the books until the 1800s, and really the rules around it have changed here and there. Even going into the 20th century, the leaders of the Senate have tinkered with what exactly a filibuster is. And like we said at the top of the show, you no longer have to be on the floor doing like a talking filibuster, like the very famous Jimmy Stewart monologue. What you can do now is you can literally pick up the phone, you can send an email to the clerk's office and say, you know, I have the votes to filibuster this, you know, we don't want this to go on the floor. And because now the Senate has rules where they can do multiple streams of business at once, you might not even know as a member of the public that there is a filibuster happening.
Steve, let's again try to lay this out in a very basic way. So the Senate requires 60 votes to pass a bill. We know that. And that really goes hand in hand with the notion of what the filibuster is capable of doing. The Senate also allows for unlimited time to debate. Debate can be stopped by cloture, right? And cloture, too, requires a 60-vote mandate to be able to stop debate and go to a vote. Have I got all that correct so far, Steve?
Yeah, so cloture, it was something invented about 100 years ago to stop all, to sort of shortchange or to stop debate. And originally they had a 67-vote threshold, then they have a 60-vote threshold. But you actually have to, on a brand-new piece of legislation, you don't need just one cloture vote. You actually have to have cloture on the motion to proceed to the bill. You can't even get to the bill these days without having 60 votes. And then you debate the bill. Every amendment can be filibustered. So you have a great idea. It's a wonderful idea, but, you know, there's a few senators who don't like it. They can filibuster. It doesn't have to be 41. Just one or two or three or four senators can actually force a very long delay. So what ends up happening, at least these days, is very few bills come to the Senate floor for actual debate. A lot of what they do happens with unanimous consent because it's just too difficult to go through the regular process. They try to do things with unanimous consent, and they do have some debate on the floor, but usually on the big matters of the day, they get rolled into one or two big packages with very few amendments, very little actual what you and I would consider to be sort of high school debate, and then they vote. And so it does take a while. It's not like you can just say, hey, I'm the majority leader. I want to close your vote in 5 minutes. You better be here. You actually have to have intervening days. There's a whole series of rules that make ending debate difficult, not just the 60-vote threshold.
Joe, one of the other things that allows the filibuster to be done, as really Tamar points out, you can really have a very quiet filibuster now, almost a secret filibuster on a measure. And the thing that allowed that to happen was when the Senate passed a rule that allowed for parallel tracks of bills. You could be filibustering one bill very quietly, not bringing it to cloture, just kind of quietly putting it aside, and yet proceed with the remainder of your business, which is why the filibuster can be used so stealthily right now.
That's right, Bill. It's great to hear Steve lay out that recent history. And what's interesting about this whole discussion is just how recent many of these changes have been. They've been since 1975, and they've become incredibly baroque in the way that these things have been used. But as what Tamar's already referenced twice is this movement afoot now to return to a talking filibuster. And if you look at the kind of classic filibusters, the actual ones, not the fictional ones that you were referencing early, but the actual ones, you know, they required a tremendous amount of coordination. And there's a great argument about, you know, that small changes can make a difference. And there should be a high cost for prolonging debate and for gumming up the work of the Senate. You know, if you look back at, say, a filibuster like 1960, there was a filibuster over civil rights legislation. It greatly weakened the bill, but there was a bill that was passed, the Civil Rights Bill in 1960. But it took a tremendous amount of time and coordination by senators on both sides of the issue. It involved a lot of elderly, privileged men being inconvenienced and taxed physically, you know, staying up late and sleeping on cots in the halls of the Senate. You know, and it would be the same today, given the average age in the Senate. The Senate hasn't changed that much, you know, since the 1960s. So it would get rid of a lot of the kind of secretive, clandestine, you know, maneuvers that Steve was talking about, and make people stand up and be accountable for gumming up the work of the American people.
Yeah, just to piggyback off that, it's hard as a journalist or somebody tracking it, as a member of the public, to figure out sometimes who's gumming up the works. There's no political cost now for filibustering legislation, and that's something that you hear a lot from people who wanna get rid of it. At the same time, we talk about how the Senate allows for dual tracks now, how you're able, even if there is filibustering, for them to get stuff done. They can confirm the president's nominees, for example. A lot of people see that as a plus because it doesn't completely grind the chamber to a halt. Because back in the day, you could debate something forever, and then the Senate is stuck on that one issue for days or weeks or months. So there is something to be said about the way things, you know, the way things are operating now, and how it does allow the chamber to get something done, even if it's not on that central issue they're debating.
Senator Chambliss, I think it's interesting that you recall the days when senators could work across the aisle. And again, you were a perfect example of that. And you still uphold the notion of the filibuster because you think it does force compromise. But you know as well as anyone that times have changed in Washington, D.C., and the poisonous, toxic partisanship in Congress makes it more and more impossible for compromise, except, I mean, there are compromises, but not on the big measures, not on something right now like the COVID relief package, like what we expect to see. We'll see what happens with the president's infrastructure bill. But you yourself, Senator, to bring up a slightly painful moment in your past, when you worked on immigration reform across the aisle and then attended the state Republican convention because you'd been working with Democrats on that measure, you got a fiercely negative reaction from many of those who had voted for you and supported you among the people in the Republican Party, which strikes me as what was happening to our politics, the extreme partisanship that has taken hold even more today.
Yeah, and that's a great example, Bill, of what's happened in the country. When you look back at the I would refer as the maybe the calming filibuster era, the 60s or beyond that. You know, there was a lot of civility, particularly among the Senate. The framers of the Constitution intended for the House to be hard charging and very partisan. But you referenced the Washington and Jefferson conversation about the cup and the salsa, and the Senate being the saucer to calm down what's happened over on the House side. That's changed, and the country has changed. We now are pretty much divided. From a population standpoint, we're a 50-50 country. And I think if we had one body that if we had both bodies to where we only had the 51 or 50% one in the case of the House plus the Senate, then what you're going to have is not something kind of akin to what we're seeing today, what's happening with executive orders. Trump passed a lot of his policy measures with executive orders. Joe Biden had campaigned on the fact that we were going to reverse those executive orders. And in fact, of the 50 or so executive orders that he has executed, so I think it's 22, were reversal policies of the Trump administration. So if you can just have the change of the bodies and have the controlling both bodies and the White House, you can reverse every policy, every law that exists out there. And I think that would be a bad policy from a political standpoint. But that's what we're headed toward if the filibuster rule is totally exhausted.
So the filibuster being used in perhaps anti-democratic ways, though, in the same way that executive orders, perhaps reconciliation, and we'll talk about all that. But Steve, I want to talk. I mentioned a little while ago that, you know, the law of unintended consequences can sometimes have a profound effect when you change rules. We're going through that in Georgia right now with our election law. There are many people who feel there will be unintended consequences to what Republicans have done in the legislature. But let's go back to the filibuster. In 2013, I think, when Saxby Chambliss was still in the chamber, Harry Reid, essentially through a tactic, a parliamentary tactic, was able to change the rules for the appointment of executive branch officers and federal judges, with the exception of the Supreme Court, because there was frustration on the Democratic side that they weren't getting their appointments through. So Reid was able to push through a rule that changed it to a majority vote on those offices I just mentioned. Right, Steve?
Yeah, so the nickname for this is sort of the nuclear option, where the chair, the president of the Senate or whoever sitting in the chair, rules based on the existing rules, and then you vote to overturn the ruling of the chair. And if you have 51 votes, that rule is toast. And it's interesting because I've seen both sides of this debate. In 2005, when the Republicans were considering using this rule change enacting this rule change because the Democrats were blocking a lot of judges, they called it, Bill Frist, who was the majority leader at the time, talked about this as the constitutional option. I remember Republicans giving speeches about and having press conferences about the Constitution does not require a supermajority. It requires a majority, and the Constitution says the House and Senate make up their own rules. And so the shoe was then on the other foot in 2013, where Mitch McConnell and Republicans were not allowing confirmations to a number of judgeships, powerful judgeships, as well as certain agency heads. And the Democrats said this is intolerable. There was another gang, just like there was a gang of 14 in 2005. There was a gang that sort of had a little bit of a deal, and then that fell apart months later. And then the Democrats said, look, this is just not working. And, you know, Mitch McConnell gave a very fiery speech about, you know, this was sort of the end of the Senate, and it was a disaster for the Republic. But when he was in charge in 2017, he had a big smile on his face and talked about how the Democrats, you know, he told the Democrats they'd live to rue the day that they did that, and he took advantage of it, and he used the same tactic to get rid of the filibuster rule for the 60-vote rule for Supreme Court justices, and you know, now there's a 6-3 conservative Supreme Court. And, you know, I am very skeptical that Mitch McConnell would not have gone nuclear to confirm a Supreme Court justice in any case, whether or not 2013 had ever happened. Because I saw 2005 when a lot of Republicans were prepared to do that. And we know how much Mitch McConnell cares about the courts. But he certainly was happy to blame it on Harry Reid and take advantage of it. But, you know, even now, when there is no 60-vote threshold, there are filibusters every day over executive branch nominees. It's just, it's a 50-vote threshold, but you still have to run the clock. You still have to go through all these procedures. You still have to have a cloture vote. So there are more cloture votes in the past 2 years, with forced by Democrats filibustering things Trump wanted or appointees Trump wanted, I think, than all the other Congresses. And so this is something that's become a delaying tactic, a sort of a power tactic to sort of force the other side to come and talk to you.
I do need to get to the first break of the show. But when we come back, Joe, I'd like to start with you going back in history a little bit. You've already talked about 1960. I think we should talk at least briefly about 1964, when Georgia U.S. Senator Richard Russell used the filibuster as a weapon in one of the most consequential fights in American government. We'll do all that and a lot more when we return from our break.
Thanks for listening to Political Rewind. If you like this show, you'll also like Georgia Today. It's a daily podcast from GPB News, bringing you compelling stories and in-depth reporting that you won't hear anywhere else. Join me, Peter Biello, for this quick and convenient way to get the best of GPB News' extensive coverage of the topics that matter to you, delivered directly to your device every weekday afternoon.
We're talking about the filibuster today on Political Rewind with Bloomberg News Washington reporter Steve Dennis, who's covered, he's been all over Washington, the White House, Capitol Hill, covering the House and the Senate. Joe Crispino, professor of American history, chair of the department, the Jimmy Carter professor of history at Emory, former United States Senator Saxby Chambliss, and my Tuesday partner, Tamar Hallerman, senior reporter at the AJC. Hey, the logo changed, Tamar. I don't know, talk about a throwback to the past.
No kidding. Very old school, kind of old-timey text. Yeah.
It's interesting to see. All right. Joe Crispino, in 1964, U.S. Senator Richard Russell was not alone, but he led off a filibuster which was designed to stop President Johnson from passing the Civil Rights Act of 1964. This was a group of Southern senators, Strom Thurmond, Richard Russell, and others, determined to stop it. And the filibuster lasted for 60 days, and LBJ could not move forward to get his legislation passed. It's an extraordinary episode in American history.
It is, but one of the things I should point out is that it's true that the filibuster almost killed the 1964 Civil Rights Act, but that's kind of putting the cart before the horse. It's like saying that the U.S. Olympic hockey team almost lost to the Russians in 1980. The point is they didn't lose to the Russians. They beat them. And what's important about 1964 is that it was the first time that civil rights forces in the Senate were able to successfully bring cloture against a Southern filibuster of a civil rights piece of legislation. And that had been, they tried to do that 11 times previously from when the cloture rule began, Rule 22 began in 1917. So it was the first time that they succeeded in that. Richard Russell actually spent a lot of that spring in Walter Reed Hospital because he was very sick. And so the Southern forces were weakened in 1964, and it was actually, this is when the dual track system began, because it became the strategy of Mike Mansfield, Senate Majority Leader, and Hubert Humphrey, who managed the legislation on the floor, to draw it out and to let public opinion swing moderate Republicans and moderate Democrats, and be able to bring a cultural vote, which they did. They got the successful vote by 4 votes. And there were, you know, this is when there were prayer vigils on the Washington Mall in favor of civil rights, and it was an enormously significant period in American history. But what's interesting about Richard Russell, if I could just say one more thing, Richard Russell, you know, was the dean of the Southern Caucus, it was called. And he's the one who organized so many of those filibusters that were successful earlier in the 40s and the 50s. But what's interesting about one of the most well-known filibusters, and that's Strom Thurmond's filibuster in 1957, they were filibustering the 57 Civil Rights Act, which was the most significant piece of civil rights legislation that Congress passed since the Reconstruction period. And it was greatly diluted. But the Southerners did not filibuster, and Richard Russell organized them so they would not filibuster that bill. He wanted to give a victory to the majority leader, his mentor, Lyndon Johnson, because he wanted to help position Lyndon Johnson to run for the presidency in 1960. So the Southern senators didn't filibuster in 1957. Strom Thurmond did a one-man lone filibuster that really irritated and put his fellow Southerners in a terrible position back home politically and got him into a lot of trouble. He was not a very popular person among his Southern colleagues in 1957 for doing that filibuster when he spoke for 24 hours and 18 minutes and set the record for the longest filibuster.
All right. So, but Tamar, I hear what Joe Crispino is saying. Nevertheless, the 64 filibuster certainly was a clear example of weaponizing the filibuster, not to reach a compromise, not to somehow find a way to have a bipartisan agreement, but rather to block legislation. And anyone who has not read Robert Caro's phenomenal 3-volume biography of Lyndon Johnson, if you're not going to read all of it, at least read the second one, Master of the Senate, which tells this story in incredibly exciting detail. But it was a weapon, Tamar, and it continues to be as President Biden tries to get some of his agenda passed.
Yeah, and it forced all the folks who were in favor of the Civil Rights Act to really kind of hustle behind the scenes to cobble together a coalition, which they were able to do at the end of the day. Hubert Humphrey, the Senate whip at the time, and then you had the Senate Minority Leader Everett Dirksen from Illinois. And eventually they were able to cobble together 71 votes, enough to overcome this filibuster. And of course, there's a very famous speech that Dirksen made on the floor where he talked about stronger than all the armies is an idea whose time has come. And certainly, yeah, I think that the social forces in the country kind of helped push a lot of folks to get to yes by that point.
Joe, and then I want to get Stephen.
I'm a school teacher, so I'm going to have to correct the history. I'm going to get in the weeds with you. But, you know, Cairo's talking about the 57 filibuster.
Oh, you're right.
Not the 64 one.
Thank you.
In fact, Robert Caro hasn't even gotten to the 64 filibuster yet. He's still waiting. You know, he's still writing. He's got books yet to write. But anyway, no, but the 64 legislation filibuster was very important. It showed it was not about compromise at all. It was the death throes of the Southern Caucus and their ability to frustrate civil rights forces in the Senate, no doubt.
Professor Crispino, thank you. Master of the Senate is about the time when Lyndon Johnson was the majority leader in the Senate and trying to force through the 57 bill. It's nevertheless an incredibly exciting read. So, Senator Chambliss and Steve Dennis, I want to get you engaged in this. Let's talk very specifically about whether we think Democrats are, in fact, the president has now said he could support some form of change in the filibuster. We know that Joe Manchin has been on the fence about this. To what extent, Steve, let me start with you, do we think that the Democrats really now want to move forward with changing the rules of the filibuster?
Yeah, I think more than 40 Democrats would vote today to do that. Probably close to 45, 46. There'd be a lot of Democrats who don't necessarily want to take that step. But, you know, there's a very long list of Joe Biden's priorities that actually were Barack Obama's priorities that did not become law in large part because of the 60-vote threshold. You know, the minimum wage hasn't gone up from 7.25. The last time the minimum wage was voted, got an increase in the Senate, was in 2007 after Nancy Pelosi attached it to the Iraq War funding bill. So it's been at 7.25 for over a decade. The gun background check issue was filibustered after Sandy Hook. I think there were 54 votes for it. Well, 54 is not 60. Union rights, immigration, the DREAM Act was filibustered in 2010. So the Democrats have a lot of pent-up ambition, and that's been thwarted. And there is no real expectation that a lot of these things are going to really move. Now, I think there's going to be some test votes. Chuck Schumer has promised to bring up gun background checks. That's going to be an interesting test for the Senate. Joe Manchin, who is sort of the leading defender of the filibuster among Democrats, says he won't get rid of it or weaken it under any circumstance. Well, right now he's negotiating with Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania and other Republicans to try to get background check expansion legislation so that if you go and buy a gun, pretty much no matter who you buy it from, you have to get a background check. Right now there are ways around that. So it will be very interesting to see what the Republican strategy is. If they start giving some victories and some compromises on some of these issues that have been intractable, where there's been no legislation for 20 or 30 years of any real consequence, that would be an interesting thing. And so I think this is the real question here for this Senate. And, you know, right now they can do reconciliation. It's an extremely painful process. There are so many things you can't include in it, things that would make sense. If you're trying to implement something, you would need regulations to go with that. You need things that might make sense go up against this thing called the Byrd Rule, named for former West Virginia Senator Robert Byrd, who wrote it in the 70s and the 80s, and suddenly you can't do the minimum wage. Suddenly you get to the floor, and suddenly your bill looks more like Swiss cheese than something that would actually make sense as a new law. So I think this is something that is coming to a head this summer. Whether or not there are going to be some bipartisan compromises. And I think also, I think Joe Manchin is trying to force those bipartisan compromises together. And we're starting to see some talk on infrastructure, this big multi-trillion dollar package. I think Joe Biden realizes that he's only got a 50-50 majority, 51-50, and he is at least reaching out to Republicans and hoping he can come up with a deal.
Senator, Steve makes an interesting point. There is some thinking that maybe Republicans on guns particularly could find a way to give ground. They could reach some kind of compromise on legislation to pass a bill that might tamp down some of the enthusiasm those 40-plus Democrats have for ending the filibuster. But one way or the other, it seems to me that you are in the camp of those saying, look, it may be in Democrats' interest right now to do this with their legislation, but watch out, Democrats, when Republicans are back in the White House, you haven't opened the door for an awful lot of, again, unintended consequences.
And that's exactly what will happen. I'm on the record for very forcefully in opposition of the action of Harry Reid in 2013, I thought that minimized the institution. Likewise, I was very in opposition of what Senator McConnell did in 2017. The Senate just is, it's been the envy of parliamentary action around the world. And these type of actions to make changes in substantive, long-standing rules, they minimize the institutions. So obviously I do think that that it, as Joe alluded there, eventually you can get through the maze of the filibuster. It's different today than it was in 64. But still, I remember an anecdote back in 2012, I guess, or 2013, when Ted Cruz was filibustering the Obamacare. Well, the Democrats are in majority. And we go to our meetings every afternoon, and Ted's ardent supporters would stand up and say, "Ted, I appreciate what you want to do, but the Democrats are in majority. How are you going to get 60 votes to do what you want to do, which is to reverse Obamacare?" We couldn't do it. So that shoe, getting on the other shoe, will be for the makeshift of a lot of bad policy. And it'll be about a lot of shifting of policy, just because all of a sudden you're going to have 51 versus 60.
Tamar, that Cruz filibuster, which ran, I think, 20 plus hours, he became notorious for, that was the green eggs and ham filibuster.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, yes. And Senator Chambliss is right. There is a ton of discussion about what the Senate would look like if the filibuster goes away. It's going to be head spinning. It'll be just like the House, or just like what we see with these new presidents coming in with executive orders. When whichever party's in the majority is going to push through everything they want at breakneck speed, they're going to, Republicans will repeal Obamacare and do all sorts of things on gun rights and immigration. And then the Democrats get in. They'll immediately try and reverse all of that. So, the parties will get what they want. You'll appeal to the bases. But I think there will be a ton of whiplash also in terms of just what people are trying to do and how quickly they'll be able to do it.
Bill, just wanted to ask Senator Chambliss. Senator, obviously you served, post-1975, after the changes, you have the two tracks and you can do these filibusters in different ways. Do you think it would make a difference if we went back to a talking filibuster to make folks have to stand up and talk to keep it going?
Well, the simple answer is no. Just because times have changed, and the operation of the Senate now, a lot of which is driven by technology, and to now think that we're going to go back to the days of when you didn't have the capability of, Tamar indicated earlier, just send an email out, and to do the stand up all nights versus the filibuster full of, versus the email, it's not practically operative today, like it was back in the pre-80s. So, I don't think so. We just operate different today than what we did back then.
Steve, I got to get to a break, but the talking filibuster has been one of the items that some have said would be a good compromise on the filibuster. Just return it to the days when you had to hold the floor for 20 hours plus if you wanted to block something. And there is still talk about that. And it's sort of, Biden seemed to suggest that might be his preference, yes?
Yeah, and even Joe Manchin in a hallway interview talked about making it painful. So there are talks right now about whether they can force people to hold the floor in one of these upcoming bills, maybe on guns, maybe on something else, maybe on voting rights. That's the big one coming up, is the voting legislation. There is zero chance the Republicans are going to allow that to pass. And the Democrats might want to make a show of having a bunch of all-nighters in a row and forcing late-night votes and all the rest. So that's something that, you know, is going to be a very sort of big test coming up, is whether they will force a talking filibuster.
I apologize, Steve. We've got to get to our final break of the show. We'll be right back. I think it was last month that Tamar Hallerman suggested that we should talk about reconciliation on this show, filibuster. And when she did, she said, you know who knows everything about reconciliation, especially? It's this guy from Bloomberg News, Stephen Dennis.
My former colleague who taught me everything I know about reconciliation.
So we've got so little time left, and I want to give everybody a chance to weigh in on it. But just in the most basic way, Steve, COVID-19 bill was passed by reconciliation. It needed a majority, not a supermajority of votes. Maybe infrastructure will be done the same way. Reconciliation is only allowed for budget-oriented bills, right?
Yeah, so there's a law that created reconciliation, which is a get-out-of-filibuster-free card. That's the way to think about it. You have this limited get-out-of-filibuster-free card. And over the years, as the Senate has become more polarized, it's more tempting to pull that out and say, okay, I'm done talking to you folks. I want something to do. I want to pass my agenda. And the Republicans did that in 2017. They tried to use it to repeal the Affordable Care Act. And John McCain cast his thumbs down. They didn't have 51 votes. Then they passed a big tax cut with reconciliation. You can do enormous things with reconciliation. One of my favorite examples is you can set the Medicare age to zero. You could pass Medicare for all in reconciliation with one line saying the Medicare age is zero. That would be seen as a budget issue. It would cost trillions of dollars, but you can do it. But you can't raise the minimum wage because that's not a government expenditure of money, or at least not enough in the eyes of the parliamentarian. You have to do two things. You have to pass a budget resolution through the House and the Senate, the same one, doesn't go to the president's desk. You have to have an all-nighter of amendments on any possible thing that any senator can force. You could have dozens of votes, hundreds of votes. It can be an all-nighter. Then you have to have the bill, and you have to have committees come up with the pieces of the bill in both chambers. You have to resolve those differences. You have to come back to the floor. You can have up to three votaramas, they call them, overnight, painful amendments on every possible thing. This is really painful. It's like getting a draft through a keyhole. By the time you're done with it, it's not going to look like you wanted it to, but you can do big things. So it's very tempting to make that keyhole larger and to use it more often. The Democrats are talking about doing that.
Tamar, you want to add something quickly?
Yeah, sure. It's just, as Steve said, such a tempting tool for Democrats. And there's so much that they can do, especially now that the parliamentarians said they can use it multiple times. Health care, they could raise taxes on the rich, they could raise the debt limit, they could lower the Medicare eligibility age, but there's plenty they can't do. Things like voting rights, things like guns, things like abortion, DC statehood. It's going to be very tempting for them to still want to get rid of the filibuster after all of this.
And Senator Chambliss, it would also increase the already tense atmosphere between Democrats and Republicans in the Senate, and I think you would call it an anti-democratic way and really a short-term way to get what you want, because the next administration can just use it in the opposite direction.
Yeah, I think McConnell has stated correctly that if you eliminate the filibuster, then it will be a scorched earth Senate. Some people would say it exists now because of the extreme partisan attitude on both sides in the Senate now, but it would increase.
Let me give Joe Crespino a chance to weigh in before we end the show.
Just taking a step back from our discussion today, and we're talking about the filibuster because we're talking about really an incredibly hyper-partisan America, and there are broad social technological changes that have contributed to where we are in a politics today. But I think it's incumbent upon us to think about ways that we can change our legislative way of doing things. Reconciliation is a terrible way to make laws for the American people, terrible way. And there are changes that we can make. Some of them are new, some of them may be old. You know, I think if we can make the American people take off work and go stand in lines to vote, then we can make our senators stand up and speak and be responsible for their votes, too. And I think that's what we should be doing.
Joe Crespino, ending the show on a positive, hopeful note. Thank you, Joe, for being with us. Stephen Dennis, what a pleasure to have you join us. Senator Chambliss, thank you. Continue on your journey to be completely healthy again. And Tamar Hallerman, of course, it was great to be with you. This is one of those days when I think, how lucky am I to get to host a show with such smart people talking? We'll do it again tomorrow. In the meantime, I'm Bill Nigut. Take care. Stay healthy. You know you're supposed to wear your mask and put it over your nose. So many people don't. And finally, if you haven't gotten the shot yet, go out and get vaccinated. There's vaccine out there. See y'all tomorrow.